From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The University of North Carolina could do a better job recruiting military veterans as students. The UNC System's Board of Governors recently heard that message from a military student advocate. You'll hear highlights from his remarks. The John Locke Foundation's chairman warns people not to rely too heavily on 2018 election results when they make predictions about 2020. You'll learn why. State legislators recently held a heated debate over loosening restrictions on North Carolina's targeted tax incentives. You'll hear competing arguments. And we'll recap North Carolina's recent success with expanding families' education options. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
How would you like to pay taxes twice on the money you save? Well, in North Carolina, you do. It's called the capital gains tax. Our next guest says that is inherently unfair, and he's proposing some ways to fix it. Dr. Roy Cordato is the senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now. Roy, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back, Donna.
So explain when we are taxed twice. Give us an example of how this works.
The thing is that the money you put in, by the way, we're talking about capital gains, mm-hmm. which means I buy something today, I sell it tomorrow. I buy a house today, sell it tomorrow. The difference in that price is what's called the capital gain.
When you make money on something.
When I make money from buying and selling, or it could be I build up a business. I start a business, I build it up, sell it 10 years later for a certain amount. The difference between what I'd put into it and what I get out of it at the end of the day is called the capital gain. Well, those are investments, and they are made with after-tax dollars. So if I invest $100 and I'm taxed 10% on it, that means I only have $90 to invest. So there, that $90 now has that 10% tax has reduced not just what I'm investing, but everything I could earn from that investment, right? By 10%. So let's say that 10 years from now, I was going to earn 10% on that, I'd get $10. Well, now I would only get $9. But then the government comes in and taxes that $9, so it's reduced twice. I know it's a little complicated. I explained it in my writing, so
right.
Hopefully people can go and look at that.
But your point is that when you invest or when you save money,
right.
which is something we encourage people
to
do,
it's penalized.
It's penalized,
yep. And that means encourages non-saving, non-investing, and so on. So
Roy, why does North Carolina do this in its
Well, it's not just North Carolina. The fact is that what we do is we tax capital gains and other investment returns as ordinary income, just in the same way we tax everything else. But generally, people recognize this problem. So, for example, at the federal level, capital gains is treated differently. It's separated out and taxed at a much lower rate to sort of help ameliorate. I mean, it doesn't solve that problem, but it ameliorates the problem.
The problem that you've already paid taxes on the money in the first place.
Right. So we're going to tax it a second time, but we're not going to do it by as much. So in the federal tax code, I believe the top rate is something like 37%, but on capital gains, you only pay 20%. So there's this capital gains differential. In North Carolina, it's taxed all the same. So
what should we do here?
Well, ideally, we should abolish the capital gains tax, but that's not going to happen.
Not
politically palatable. It hasn't been politically palatable at the federal level. It's not going to be politically palatable at the local level or at the state level. But we can do some things to sort of move in the direction of getting the kind of differential between regular income and capital gains like they have in the federal tax code. So what I propose is very, very modest. It is basically to cap all taxes on capital gains at the current flat rate of 5.25%, which is paid on everything else. That doesn't change anything in the near term, right? But if I had to bet right now, my guess is our taxes are going to go up in the future, right? So let's say that the top tax rate goes up to 6%, even to 7%. Well, that capital gains rate would stay at 5.25, and it would create that differential like you have in the federal tax code. On the other hand, if taxes go down, hopefully, but again, I'm not sure I'd put my money on that at this point, the capital gains tax would go down with it. And the other thing I suggest is that we adjust the capital gains tax for inflation, because some capital gains are what are called phantom capital gains. So let's say I buy a house and it goes up by 10% in 10 years. And over those 10 years, we've had 10% inflation. Well, the value of my house isn't increased at all. It's the same as it was. But I would still get taxed on that perceived gain, and that's why they call them phantom gains, because it's not really a gain at all once you adjust for the cost of living and inflation and everything. So what I add in is I say going forward, we should also just add a plain fairness. I mean, it's just not fair to tax someone on gains they don't even get, right? So that what we should do is adjust capital gains for inflation.
Roy, I know that you have written about this for a number of years, mm-hmm. and you think that this is really something that should be addressed. By the way, you can read Roy's work on this at johnlock.org. Some people, however, will listen to us and say, well, Dr. Cordato, that sounds really great, but what you're really talking about is something just for the rich. Why should someone who is not a wealthy person mm-hmm. care about how savings and investment is treated?
Well, a number of reasons. First of all, it's not just for the rich. For example, lots and lots of people have 401ks, IRAs, right? Or own a house, right? I mean, these are investments. Also, small businesses. I mean, one of the big ways they hope to get, to earn money from that business is someday you build it up and you sell it for more. You have a big capital gain on it down the road and you sell it. And then, you know, people will go, well, that's going to be my retirement, right. Savings is that business, right? A guy who owns a pizza parlor or something. So it's not just for rich fat cats. Lots of people benefit from capital gains. Lots of people are in the stock market, now. So it's not just that, but on top of that, the fact is that to the extent that this discourages investment helps everybody, right? We invest, businesses investing to produce goods and services that benefit society generally. And, to the extent it discourages that, discourages economic growth, across the board.
I know that you would really like the General Assembly to take some sort of reform action on this, as you outline mm-hmm. in your plan at johnlock.org. Who knows whether they will or not? We do know that over the past half dozen years or so, that state legislators have embarked on what many people in other states, looking at North Carolina, say is really historic, very large tax reform efforts,
right.
Multiple actions
yes.
that have reformed the tax code. Give us a sense of your view of what's gone on.
It's been great. I mean, we created a flat tax in North Carolina and lowered it from 7.25%, I believe, down to now 5.25% flat rate. We've increased the standard deduction for people who are at the lower incomes. We have taken the corporate tax, more than cut it in half. We have done great things in that area. This is just one thing we haven't done is do anything about the capital gains tax, which is why I'm saying, look, we've done great things up till now, but there's more that can be done. And this is one of the things we should be looking at.
And everything that you described really translates into working people keeping more of what they earn.
Absolutely. That's what it's all about.
That's been the result. Roy, on this issue of the standard deduction, mm-hmm. The zero tax bracket,
right.
Give us a sense of why you say that helps low and moderate income people.
The whole idea is you're exempting a portion of your income. The first, well, now it's for a married couple, it's going up to $20,000. You're making $60,000 a year or $50,000 a year. Well, the first $20,000 is going to be taxed at zero. So you're only going to be taxed if you're making $50,000 on $30,000. That's a major tax benefit.
Roy, thanks so much for helping us understand all this about capital gains.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Should the University of North Carolina pay more attention to enrolling military veterans as students? Jared Lyon thinks so. Lyon is president and CEO of Student Veterans of America. He recently addressed the UNC System's Board of Governors.
It is presumed, and I almost feel terrible saying this, but I've traveled to 313 college and university campuses in 48 states over the past 4 years, doing presentations similar to this. And there's a notion that continues to pervade, and it goes something like this. Well, gee golly, veterans, thank you for your service. We appreciate that. But I mean, let's be honest. If these folks were smart enough to get into college, how'd they wind up in the military? This is an absolutely false notion. So if you look at the overall aggregate data, here's what's rather interesting. If we look at some colleges defined as having earned an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree or higher, the entire veteran population in the United States, that 20 plus million, about 62% of us have achieved an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree or higher. Compared to society, civil society, that it is higher. But if you look at the post 9/11 generation, my generation that is currently in school and has recently graduated, actually 76% of us have already achieved an associate's degree, bachelor's degree or higher. You show me a subsect of the U.S. population that has that high concentration of earned degrees. The notion that veterans don't go to college, and even if they do, they won't succeed, is simply false.
Lyon says current members of the military have a strong interest in education.
92% indicated that education should play a key role in their post-service transition. And currently, with 4.1 million post-9/11 veterans, this number is growing as service members get out. And let me put more specific numbers to transition. Each and every single year, our country will produce, on average, 200,000 veterans. What's really interesting about this is what happens when they leave. So, two things are important to understand here in the state of North Carolina. About 80% of transitioning service members, when they separate from active duty, will do one of two things when they get out. The first is that they will either stay where their last duty station was. So if they served here in North Carolina, high percent chance that they'll actually stay here in North Carolina. The other set is that they will go home to where they or their spouse are from originally. By going home, I mean returning to where they're from. And North Carolina produces a whole lot of veterans. So you've got them coming and going with regard to the state's prosperity by being able to leverage this asset-based population.
Lyon looks more closely at the number of veterans heading to college.
Out of 200,000, about 52% of the population will be in a college classroom within 7 months of separating from active duty. Now, a lot of people will say, okay, what about the other 48%? I'll remind you that it's a whole pie, and stay with me on my professor's prerogative here with the pie chart, right? So 52% straight to college. 32% of that population separates from active duty already in possession of a bachelor's degree or higher. That's 100% of our officer corps and about 14% of our enlisted force that either had the degree before they enlisted or completed it while they were in using tuition assistance. So when we say that college is not for everybody, it is a true statement. When we try to apply that statement to the post 9/11 era of veterans, it is only true for 16% of my generation, meaning that the overwhelming majority of us are either already completed our degrees or are pursuing. Put in another way, 115,000 student veterans will be coming to a college classroom each and every year, and that is a renewable population for at least predicted the next 10 years. 115,000 new students that you could be enrolling nationwide.
That's the voice of Jared Lyon, president and CEO of Student Veterans of America. He's making a case for boosting the number of military veterans at universities.
This is a talent-laden population, and as systems are starting to look for ways to replace lost revenue, either through state funding, federal funding, or other student populations that we've traditionally recruited into our communities from a tuition and fees perspective, I'd like to make the business case for why veterans are not only outperforming their civilian counterparts, but with the dollars that they're bringing to post-secondary education, which are federally backed through the GI Bill, are very important. But this idea that veterans are not going to do well in post-secondary education, it's not a new one. So with the advent of the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, this is how we brought a generation of World War II veterans home. But there was this sort of pervasive idea among America's elite institutions of higher learning that veterans were not going to be college material. This is kind of not only false, but it adds a little bit of vinegar to the wound when university presidents from the University of Chicago and Harvard published op-eds, petitioned Congress not to include an education provision in the act because they not only believed that the average World War II veteran, though they were grateful for their service, defeating fascism, and freeing the world for democracy, they just didn't believe that they were going to do well in college. And so they quite literally used language that said that they believed that they would create hobo towns on their college and university campuses, coming only for the college money, and that they would flood the campus and degrade the quality of the education. But this is actually kind of funny because just three short years later, those same two university presidents published retractions saying, my only complaint is that my campus is crowded with too many high-achieving veterans that are overwhelming the dean's list. We were wrong. This is the absolutely most studious population that we have on our campus. How do we get more of them?
Lyon presented to UNC leaders what he called the business case for pursuing more military veterans as students.
The current generation of student veterans are highly motivated to excel in college. Top motivations for why the current generation of folks are enlisting in the military right now, 53% say that their primary motivation is for the education benefits. 52% say a desire to serve their country, and 49% say that the opportunity to pursue new experiences, adventures, or travel are why they're coming in. But military influence on post-service aspirations, 73% of current service members reported that the military service experience promoted their interest in education, and 68% of service members surveyed said that the military actually prepared them for college. However, many in higher education today still have doubts about actively recruiting student veterans to their campus because of this notion that they have an assumption that they won't do well.
Why are veterans such an asset on campus? Lyon says he's searched for empirical answers to that question.
Backed by research as to why we want this population, not only in our classrooms, but as part of our campus community, and more importantly, I think, part of our alumni base and our tax base as they graduate. But 87% have strong work ethic and discipline, then teamwork, leadership and management skills, mental toughness. This has also been described in higher education as resiliency, especially at the undergraduate level. This is something that we're struggling with in post-secondary education all over the country. Now, this population is incredibly resilient. They're adaptive to different challenges. They have a high degree of self-discipline, and 78% of the population cites professionalism as the thing that they're most proud of.
Lyon says military veterans can help college campuses improve their diversity.
For white males, degree attainment is higher at the associates and graduate level, but slightly below for student veterans in the four-year degree than white males that have never served. But in every other diversity and inclusion category, what these numbers represent is that veterans for white women, African-American men and women, and Latino and Latinas are outperforming their civilian counterparts that have never served by anywhere from 3 to 18%, which is absolutely fantastic.
North Carolina already has a significant number of students student veterans.
Actually, you have the sixth highest enrollment of student veterans of any state. So you're just edging out Georgia right now. You have over 34,000 student veterans that are currently using GI Bill benefits here in the state. And that totaled last year $424 million to the state through tuition and fees just last year alone.
That's Jared Lyon, president and CEO of Student Veterans of America. He recently offered University of North Carolina leaders a business case for pursuing more student veterans. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Political observers are already turning their attention to 2020 elections. Some want to look at the recent 2018 elections for clues about the next big races for president, Congress, governor, and legislature. John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood urges caution.
This does not tell you very much about 2020. I'm just here to tell you. What I'm saying about that is, well, let's look at the Michigan Senate race or the Michigan governor's race or the Pennsylvania House races and decide which way they're going to go for Trump. This is a fool's errand, folks. That is the wrong way to do it. This is up for grabs. We don't know who the candidates are going to be. In 2016, in my opinion, certainly after the fact, it was all about the particular matchup. If President Trump had been against anybody other than a Clinton, he might have lost. I think that if Clinton had been against, a variety of other Republicans, she would have lost larger. So it has to do with the matchup. It has to do with the specific individuals in a race. And I am not assuming that Trump will be the nominee. I think if he runs, he'll be the nominee, but I'm not quite so sure he'll run. But if he runs, I'm not so sure he couldn't win again. He might be able to pull off something like the same kind of flip of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio. Might still happen. But it may also prove to be kind of a fluke that couldn't. I just think it's uncertain. So I'm going to focus on North Carolina. I think that Governor Cooper is in good shape, but he's not in great shape. He's in good shape because his disapproval ratings are low. People don't really have a strong opinion about him, but if they have an opinion about him, it's mildly positive or maybe strongly positive. And that's a good sign for him. But as we have seen, our races in North Carolina are pretty darn competitive. He only won, as I said, by plurality of 0.2 of a point. And if Dan Forrest, for example, or some other Republican runs an effective campaign in a year, the dynamics of which we really don't know yet, Cooper could be in trouble. The Supreme Court can't flip for a while. But the governor's race is up for grabs. And yes, under the current maps, the current maps won't stick. Under the maps that will be in place in 2020, Democrats can make gains in Congress or none. The Republicans have a fairly good shot of taking back some seats in Wake and Mecklenburg and places like that that they lost if it's a different electorate, different year. But it is also theoretically possible you'd end up after the 2020 elections with 62 or 63 Democrats in the House, 26, 27 Democrats in the Senate, which again, I'll return to my final and make my final point. If you're comfortable with that as a Republican and you want them to draw the maps, then by all means, don't reform the system.
That's John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood speaking recently in Raleigh. He urges caution for those who want to apply 2018 election results to 2020. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina is expanding its targeted tax incentive program. A recent change allows companies collecting a Job Development Investment Grant, or JDIG, to claim more money for every new job they create in the state. Outgoing Republican Representative Bill Brawley endorses the change.
Currently, there is a cap of $6,500 per job brought to North Carolina. We are raising the cap to $16,000 per job. Now, it's still a percentage of the taxes paid. What this allows us to do is to compete for high-wage relocations like corporate headquarters. Right now, we're not in the running. What we are changing is, what is the amount per job that we can pay for a corporate headquarters or a high-skill facility where wages are higher than about $150,000 a year? And while I'm not in danger of being recruited for a high six- or seven-figure job, I certainly think the state is helped by having those jobs come to North Carolina rather than Atlanta, so that we can collect those taxes, not another state.
Republican Representative Scott Stone compared the incentives to decisions he makes as a business owner.
If I pay a signing bonus to a new employee because they can benefit our company and make us more competitive and make us better as an entire company, why do my other employees care? I didn't cut their salaries to give that other person a signing bonus. So what difference does it make to the employees that are being paid a fair market value and getting a fair deal already if we're recruiting somebody from the outside to come and make our company better. That's how I kind of look at this a little bit. But specifically to the JDIG and to this specific bill, this is not a change that helps one county or one company while hurting others. This does not hurt anyone else.
Republican Representative Susan Martin tried to answer criticism about incentives.
It's true. It's not about the incentives. It's about the things that we've been doing, the tax policy, the business climate, a workforce. That's what I would have guessed would have been the most important thing, is the workforce, the infrastructure. Do we have the roads? Do we have broadband in the rural areas? All of these things are what makes a difference for if a company is going to come to North Carolina. Unfortunately, the incentives are required. They're a piece that in the competitive environment we're in, and right now with the economy growing, and we know it's going to go in cycles, so how long is this going to remain? Companies are making these decisions now. They're reshoring, they're putting in manufacturing, they're considering it because we're in a good growth position as a country. So this is the time that we need to be competing for these opportunities. They're not always available. And when you look at how the companies are making a decision and they look at the spreadsheet, this is peanuts compared to the other pieces, but it does matter, and we do need to compete for that.
House Democratic Leader Darren Jackson touted the benefits of incentives helping to bring 750 jobs and a new corporate headquarters to the state.
Those 750 families, they're not eating out at restaurants in whatever area in this state they're going to pick. They will be next year. They're not going necessarily to the North Carolina beaches or the North Carolina mountains and visiting and spending their recreational dollars going to basketball games and football games in the state of North Carolina right now, today, but they will. Our citizens will benefit from bringing this corporate headquarters and other corporate headquarters who might use this provision in the future.
You've been listening to supporters of a recent change in North Carolina's targeted tax incentive program. Other members of the State House of Representatives remain unconvinced. Republican Representative Jonathan Jordan offered this assessment.
One of the biggest corporate welfare and crony capitalism bills I think I've ever seen. A 246% increase in the bounty or price that jobs are going for now. We're told that the state makes money on this deal. If that's the case, why don't we put this in place for every job? The small businesses in your communities, when they create jobs, when the local electrician hires an assistant, when landscapers hire workers, restaurant hire workers, kitchen and service staff, where's their $16,000 per job? They created jobs for our communities, but only the big guys get the money, only the corporate welfare to the big corporations. We are not in the business of investing taxpayer money into risky business schemes. We are here to provide infrastructure, court system, things that people can't do for themselves. And that would be great because, you see, all of our companies, all of our businesses can take advantage of new infrastructure. But instead, we're giving a large company $16,000 per job. If you follow this issue, corporate welfare, crony capitalism, you know this is an issue that combined, that puts the left and the right together. The North Carolina Justice Center and Policy Watch and the John Locke Foundation, left and right, they're against this. Taxpayers ought to be against this too, giving away their money to corporations. How dare we? How dare we do that? You tell your local employers, your local small business people, I just gave the big company down the street a bunch of money, but for you, nah, I don't think so. I guess because it only could produce one or two jobs at a time. Is that the difference?
Jordan isn't the only Republican with complaints about targeted tax incentives. Representative Larry Pittman.
For years, I heard Republicans complain about corporate welfare and how we ought to, you know, take over state government and get rid of that. Then we take control and take it over as our own, you know, and I never have understood that or been willing to be part of it. Forbes has rated us again as the best place in the country to do business. And a big part of that has been how we've reduced taxes and regulation. And I think what we need to do, the right way to handle things, is to keep doing that. Corporate income taxes, for instance, to me make absolutely no sense. Because it wastes personnel time and resources of a company to keep up with that, take care of making sure those are paid and all that sort of thing. And then they just pass the cost along to consumers. So what's the point of that? I think we ought to just do away with corporate income taxes right this minute. We shouldn't even have those. I think it'd be a better way to handle things. But I think we should stop corporate welfare. And maybe, you think about all these different programs that we have, all these millions of dollars going into incentives, programs, and stuff like that. Just think if we took that money instead and put it into schools and roads and better pay for our highway patrol officers and that sort of thing.
Representative Michael Speciale also registered his opposition.
The example that was given about giving a bonus to an employee, that's a fine example, except that it doesn't fit here. And the reason it doesn't fit here is because if you're the employer, that's your money. You can spend your money any way you like. But we're not spending our money. We're spending taxpayer money. And incentives is taxpayer money. Regardless of whether you're looking at physical dollars, it's dollars we're not getting that we should be getting. It's dollars we're giving away. If we're letting them have $6,500 per employee, and now we're going to raise it by almost $10,000, well, then that's more money we're not getting for infrastructure and to pay all the bills that we have to pay in the for the state. So it does affect everybody. It is coming from somewhere else. Incentives are not what draws people here. And we keep shooting ourselves in the foot because we started off with some great ideas and some great programs. Let's cut corporate taxes, and we have. And that's why there are businesses looking at North Carolina, because we've cut corporate taxes. We need to just continue on the plan that we're on. Let's cut it until it's at zero. This is what's going to bring business here.
Regardless of opposition, the incentive measure moved forward. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Roughly 8 out of 10 North Carolina kids attends a traditional public school. That means that the remaining 20% or so of the kids in the state are actually educated in a school of choice. It may be a public charter, a home school, or a private school. In fact, the demand for more options is growing as North Carolina takes a leadership role in the school choice movement, a movement celebrated this very week across the country. Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies, and a person who is very well connected with the folks who organize National School Choice Week. Terry, by the way, is also a founder of a public charter school in North Carolina. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the market share, so to speak, of schools of choice, roughly 20%. How do we compare across the country?
That's one of the higher market shares as far as school choice markets go in the nation. We have an interesting situation in North Carolina because of our massive homeschool population. That's really what makes our market share kind of distinctive compared to some of the other school choice states like Arizona, Florida, and Indiana, is that estimates that I've seen show that North Carolina has the third largest number of homeschoolers in the nation, third only to Texas and California. So, with such a large homeschool population, with a surging number of charter school students, and with a slowly increasing number of private school students, our market share compares pretty favorably to some of the states that have had school choice programs for much longer than we have.
Do we have any data or even perspective from homeschool parents and homeschool kids as to why that option is so popular here?
Well, it's diversified, and I think that's the key. I was recently quoted in the News and Observer on this very subject because we are finding more and more that the parents that are choosing to homeschool are not the typical evangelical parents that have homeschooled in the past. They are parents that are concerned about the safety of their child. They're concerned about the rigor of what they find in district schools, and the rigor is usually wanting. And so the reasons for homeschooling go way beyond sort of inculcating a religious or a moral instruction. It has gone much broader than just the evangelical community. Those on the center, those on the left are increasingly homeschooling at larger rates. And the percentage of parents that are saying that they're homeschooling for religious reasons is on the decline in North Carolina, indicating that it's become an incredibly diverse, well-accepted movement in North Carolina, and it's happening in other states as well.
We also have demand for seats in public charter schools. In fact, I mentioned that you are a founder of a new public charter school in Wake County, North Carolina. What is the appeal of a charter school?
Well, the appeal is there. It really depends on the parents. I always have to go back to that. But I think
kind of the point.
Lots of
parents have
right.
different ideas for why they may choose a non-traditional classroom.
That's right. But what I have found is the parents have three main reasons why they want to choose a charter school. First, it's a singular entity. And if you're in a district like Wake County, for example, that has 160,000 kids, you feel a little overwhelmed by such a large district. And so to be able to go to a school that is basically doing its own thing on its own is appealing to a lot of parents. The second thing is that they usually offer a very unique instructional approach. They offer things that you can't find in a traditional district school, different ways of approaching the curriculum, different ways of approaching testing, and that's really, really, really appealing to a lot of parents. And then finally, it's things that is that are difficult to quantify, like proximity to one's home, the size of the school, the size of the classroom, these kind of factors that parents sort of instinctively understand but aren't really always very vocal about wanting. So those are really the three factors that we have found at the charter school that I co-founded that parents are really looking for in charter schools. And their appeal, of course, continues to increase as the charter schools become much more diverse in their instructional approach and the students that they have in the school and in the ability of charter schools to reach students in rural communities, which hadn't always been the case.
And that's a really important point, I think, about the rural areas of the state. Are we seeing public charter schools crop up in those areas where it may be a smaller population of kids?
Absolutely. And it's been a long time coming, because when we had a cap on charter schools, and it wasn't so long ago that the state had imposed a 100 school cap on charters. Fortunately for the Republican General Assembly, they eliminated that cap in 2011. But before that, it was very hard to get a charter to start a school. And there was such a risk with starting a charter school in a rural community that many resisted the move to do so. Now that we don't have a cap on the number of charter schools, we find a lot more willingness, especially from folks in rural communities, to found charter schools that may not be the mega charter schools that enroll 1,500 or 2,000 kids, but a small charter school that's enrolling 300 or 400 kids in a predominantly rural community.
Now, the rap on charters, of course, from those who oppose the idea is that, well, you are attracting parents who are very involved in their kids' education already, and essentially you're choosing the cream of the crop, so to speak, that would attend those schools. And that's why they're popular, and that's why in many cases they do so well.
And it's a ridiculous claim. I mean, there is no evidence that that's the case. Now, it is true that there are charter schools that attract very well-to-do parents. But there's also charter schools that attract mostly low-income, mostly minority students, and we're seeing more and more of those schools be created in communities of color and low-income communities. So there really isn't a whole much of a leg for them to stand on when they make that claim. It's a claim that's been around for decades and unfortunately has been embedded in the media narrative for so long that people just accept it as fact. But in North Carolina, it is not the fact.
And in fact, public charters are tuition free. That's also
kind of
a myth that somehow you have to pay extra money. No, that's not true.
That's right. And the other point is that charter schools can't just pick students. If there are more applicants than the number of seats available, they have to use a lottery. Can't really pick and choose when you're using a lottery to pick the number of the students that get seats in that school.
Terry, there's also some about 100,000 enrollment or so in private schools in North Carolina. But it does seem, based on the stats that you've been writing about, that private schools seems to have pretty much plateaued.
Yeah, it has. And during the Great Recession, the population for private schools decreased for obvious reasons. Parents didn't have the kind of money to be able to pay the tuition. Now that we have some private school choice programs in North Carolina, we've seen something of a rebound, but even those programs aren't growing very quickly. I don't think we're going to see huge increases in our private school population. It's going to stay at around 100,000 students, perhaps increase by a few hundred each year. But we're not going to see the kind of growth in private schools as we've seen in home schools and charter schools by any means.
Now, this week, Terry, you and other proponents of school choice and, of course, the John Locke Foundation being a proponent of empowering parents with more choices, we've all been celebrating National School Choice Week. Why is that an important thing to do?
Coming together to celebrate the freedom of parents to be able to choose the choice of education that best meets the needs of their kids, I think, is absolutely critical.
Terry Stoops, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.